This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in this week for Terry Gross. The most enduring images and sounds of Martin Luther King's life come from his I Have a Dream speech, delivered at the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963. Our guest, Clarence Jones, helped draft the text King held that day, and he was standing a few feet away when King spoke. As he'll soon explain, the words I Have a Dream weren't originally part of the speech. Jones was a young attorney and part of King's inner circle when the March on Washington was planned, and he tells his story in a new book called Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. Clarence Jones is currently a scholar in residence and visiting professor at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. He also writes regularly for The Huffington Post. I spoke to him about Martin Luther King and his historic speech last week. I asked him to read from the beginning of the book.
A quarter of a million people, human beings who generally had spent their lives treated as something less, stood shoulder to shoulder across the vast lawn, their hearts beating as one. Hope won the line, when hope was an increasingly scarce resource. There is no dearth of prose describing the mass of humanity that made its way to the feet of the great emancipator that day. No metaphor that has slipped through the cracks waiting to be discovered, dusted off, and injected into the discourse a half century on. The March on Washington has been compared to a tsunami, a shockwave, a wall, a living monument, a human mosaic, an outright miracle. It was all of those things, and if you saw it with your own eyes, it wasn't hard to write about. With that many people in one place crying out for something so elemental, you don't have to be Robert Frost to offer some profound eloquence. Still, I can say to those who know the event only as a steely black-and-white television image, it's a shame that the colors of that day, the blue sky, the vibrant green life, the golden sun everywhere, are not part of our national memory. There is something heart-wrenching about the widely shown images and film clips of the event that belies the joy of the day.
Well, Clarence Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. I thought we'd begin, before we talk about the march, I want you to tell us how you and Martin Luther King met, how he got you involved in the movement.
Well, it was, I was a 29-year-old lawyer, just a graduate of law school some 7 months previous to that. I just moved to California, and I got a call in February of 1960 from Judge Hubert Delaney, who was a well-known lawyer and judge here in New York. And he said, Clarence, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., you know, the preacher from Alabama, has been indicted for tax evasion and perjury, and I'm the head of the defense team. But he said, we need a law clerk. We need someone who can do all the legal research. But we need you to come to Montgomery, Alabama, and work with us. And I said, Judge, I'd like to, but, you know, I just got here, and I just can't do it. And I could tell that he was disappointed with me, and he hung up the phone. The following morning, I get a call from Judge Delaney, and he said, you know, I didn't know it at the time that we had our conversation last night, but Dr. King, he's on his way to California. He has a speaking engagement there on Saturday, and I had suggested to him that he stop by and see you. And so Friday evening, there's a knock on my door. Two gentlemen show up. One has a hat on, and he says, Mr. Jones, I'm Martin King, and this is my colleague, Reverend Bernard Lee, so forth. So he comes in. And to put it in historical context, he was then regarded as what, as a celebrity. At least he was regarded as such by my wife, who thought that when Martin Luther King Jr. was coming to our home, there was a combination of Moses, Jesus, George Clooney, Sidney Poitier, and whoever, Michael Jackson. So in he comes, and he sits down. We have some pleasantries and so forth, and he gets right to the point. He says, you know, Mr. Jones, we have lots of white lawyers who help us in the movement, but what we need is that we need more young Negro professionals, more Negro lawyers who can help us, because every time we are embarked on something, we're being hit with some kind of legal action, and it's draining us. And I listened very attentively, and I said, Dr. King, I admire you and what you are seeking to do. But as I said to Judge Delaney, you know, it's just really not possible for me at this time.
But you know, as you describe this in the book, although you say you were respectful and you were, you know, admired what he was doing, as you describe it, it sort of sounds like you were a little bit disdainful. Like, you know, some preacher.
Well, my wife thought I was. That's why I was going to continue, because yeah. She said, as soon as he left, she turned to me and she said to me, what are you doing that's so important that you can't help this man? And so she was angry at me. And then I began to be angry at Martin King, because I thought to myself, you know, like all young couples, you know, we were living in relative domestic tranquility, and here this total stranger comes into my house and gets my wife angry at me over something I had nothing to do with. So that was not a pleasant evening. And so the following morning, however, telephone rings, and a woman on the phone says, Mr. Jones? I said, yes. She says, my name is Dora McDonald. I'm Dr. King's secretary. Dr. King enjoyed so much his visit with you and Mrs. Jones, but he forgot to extend to you an invitation to be his guest tomorrow. He's preaching in Los Angeles, and he would like for you to attend as his guest. So I listened, and I said, well, thank you very much. My wife was standing nearby, and I told her verbatim the conversation I just had with Dora McDonald. And here again, she said, well, you may not be going to Montgomery, Alabama, but you're going to that church. So I go to the church. Now, this is a church in Baldwin Hills. Now, at that time, Baldwin Hills was and still is, but maybe to a lesser extent now, since blacks can move into Bel Air and Brentwood and other places. But at that time, Baldwin Hills was the section, neighborhood in Los Angeles where the black bourgeoisie, the so-called accomplished black professionals live. So I go into the church. Dr. King is introduced, and he gets up, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the text of my sermon today is the role and responsibility of the Negro professional to aid our less fortunate brothers and sisters who were struggling for freedom in the South. So I thought to myself, this is one smart dude. this is actually, he's come right to the right church in the right pew. I had never heard anyone speak with such extraordinary eloquence and power. And then during the course of this very eloquent description of what he was seeking to do through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he pauses and he says, and for example, there's a young man sitting in this church today, and he's not looking at me, he's just preaching. There's a young man sitting in this church today, and my friends in New York, whom I have great respect, they tell me that this young man's brain has been touched by the Lord. They tell me that this young lawyer, that when he does legal research, he can go into the books and go all the way back to the time of William the Conqueror in 1066 and the Magna Carta. And then when he finds it and writes it down, my friends in New York, whom I have great respect for, tell me the words he writes are so compelling, they just jump off the page.
Did you know he was talking about you?
No. So I have not the slight, I don't, he's not looking at me. I don't think he's talking about me at all. And if it could not have been me, because it was the most, it would be an exaggerated description of me. So I'm thinking, I want to meet this dude he's talking about. I want to connect up and, you know, see who this person. And then he goes on, he says, but I had a chance to meet with this young man the other night. And he began to describe his coming to my home. And he described his meeting with me. He's not looking at me. And he then, in the course of telling that, he says, but, and this young man has forgotten from whence he came. And he says, like so many of you in this audience, in this church here today, somebody made it possible for you to have a measure of success. And I get tearful Sermon's over. Okay. He, as I said, he's like a rock star. So he's standing at the on the steps to the entrance to the pulpit outside the church, and I walk over to him. And as I walk over to him, he looks at me like a Cheshire cat has swallowed a mouse. He says, "I never mentioned your name, Mr. Jones. I never mentioned your name." And I walk over to him, and I put my hand in his hand, and I said, "Dr. King, when do you want me to go to Montgomery, Alabama?" Since then, that transformed my life.
So if we fast forward then a few years, it's 1963, and you know, the movement's rolling. You're at this point an attorney. You're working with Martin Luther King, part of his inner circle, traveling with him. And they begin to plan this March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, a kind of a revival of an idea that A. Philip Randolph had come up in the 30s, as you mentioned.
That is correct.
And you said King's life at that time was so frenetic that he needed a place to – be a little more secluded so he could plan. So you gave him your house in Riverdale for that purpose. And one of the interesting things about your description is that you were having all of these conversations about how to build a crowd, how to build a coalition of people, of speakers, of interest, and the FBI was listening to all of it. Did you suspect that at the time?
No, we did not suspect it at that time. Every telephone conversation that took place from my home or my office where Martin Luther King Jr. was on the other end of the phone, was wiretapped. I didn't have any suspicion, but as it began to be like in 64, 65, I began to have some suspicion. It was just a gut reaction. And at that time, our conference calls would frequently start around 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and I would have had maybe two or three martinis and maybe a little Jack Daniels before the conference call. And I remember before we'd start the conference call, we'd get on the phone, and I would say, "Hold on, everybody." And I would say something like, "Now, Mr. FBI man, now, are you ready? Do you have your pencil and paper? Now, I just want you to be sure you get this down accurately, because we have a lot to talk about." And Dr. King would say, "All right, Clarence, you know, enough with the theatrics, you know. I mean, they got better things to do," he would say. "They have better things to do."
Well, I know that
listening to our conversations, I said, yeah, Martin, but I'm sure they are.
Well, and you later learned that Robert Kennedy himself, the attorney general at the time, had personally authorized the tap on your phone.
That is correct.
I'm wondering, would you have behaved differently? Would the conversations have been different if you'd known the FBI was listening?
Yes, I think we would have. We would have been less forthcoming.
Now as you planned the march, the plan was that the march would end at the Capitol building, and that Martin Luther King and the other leaders would speak on the top steps of the Capitol. And as we all know, it ended up being at the Lincoln Memorial. Why was that?
Well, initially, when it was the march was unfolding, the plans, it was planned to be on the steps of the Capitol building, but President Kennedy and the Attorney General, particularly the President, there was a pending civil rights bill in Congress, and he very strongly said that it would be counterproductive that the Congress would regard the demonstration at the Capitol steps as considering the civil rights bill with a gun pointed to its head. And so the A. Philip Randolph, the Bayard Rustin, Dr. King, the other members of the several organizations decided that, yes, it would, to make that question a non-issue, we moved it to the foot of the Lincoln Memorial.
So there was enormous planning building up to the March on Washington that August of 1963. And there was the matter of Martin Luther King's speech. There were going to be a lot of speakers. He would speak last. Was there ever any question that Martin Luther King would be the final speaker, or that he would have more time than the others?
Oh, absolutely. There was a question of that. During the week preceding that, there was the behind-the-scenes discussion among the Big Six or their representatives about who was going to be the last speaker. A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and Cleveland Robinson from labor leader, myself, we felt, and Martin himself felt, that he should be the last speaker. But he certainly felt it was inappropriate for him to suggest that. And so I had a discussion with A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, joined with Cleveland Robinson. And I said, well, I think he should be the last speaker, I said, I believe that most people who are coming to this march, with all due respect to the other members of the Big Six organizations, they're really coming in anticipation of hearing Dr. King. There was some resistance. So finally, I remember saying, let's think about it. Do you really want to follow Martin Luther King Jr.? Do you really want to follow him?
Right.
And there was this dead silence. And that was it.
You know, I know that at this point, I mean, you know, this was 1963, and the movement had had years of experience, and with the media, with local officials, with tactics of, you know, protest, and I know there was a lot of savvy consideration of how it would be perceived and how the message would be generated. Were people thinking about television then, about how it would look on television?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the person among us who gave us an education on the power of television was really Harry Belafonte. He said, you have to look at this as a media event, not just as a march. And so, for example, Harry was responsible for assembling what was called the celebrity delegation, a lot of celebrities from Hollywood and performing artists. And he was very firm that they should sit in a certain strategic part on this podium, because he knew that the television cameras would pan to them, would look to them. And so he wanted to be sure that they were strategically situated so that in looking at the celebrities, they'd also see a picture of the march and the other performers. Yes, we were very much concerned about that. And then Martin King was especially concerned about the white-black composition of the march. So we were hopeful that there would be, a minimum of 25% or more of white people who would attend the march. In fact, participation was somewhere between 20 and 25% maximum. And to that extent, he was disappointed.
So the day arrives. You wake up in the morning. Martin Luther King had stayed up working on his speech, and you write that you were relieved to see that it was finished and copies were being mimeographed for distribution to the media that would be assembled. And a concern occurred to you about whether it should be copyrighted. Tell us about that.
Well, when I learned that the speech was being mimeographed, I actually got over to the press tent where all the media was assembled, and I saw them putting in this copy into brown envelopes, along with a lot of press materials, folders about the march. And I cannot really say why I did it. Something occurred to me because I'd had the experience of so many people trying to rip off and take advantage of used material that had either been written or spoken by Martin. And so I said to myself, I'm going to put a little circle with a C in it on the mimeograph copies, just to protect what is called the common law copyright, without getting into a lot of discussion. It's just that a lot of people may not know is that anytime a person creates a book or a writing, is that you have what is called the common law copyright. That's you created it, it's yours. But that common law copyright, if you distribute it over a wide audience, if it's not a limited distribution, you will extinguish your common law copyright. So putting a notice of the common law copyright was a way of protecting that. So that's what I did.
And what's been the impact of your having copyrighted that speech?
Well, the impact of that, you'd have to understand, after the march is over, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm in New York City, and I'm walking down the street, and I hear record stores playing a recording of the speech. So I got back to my law office, and I checked the information in the record jack, and I finally reached the offices of 20th Century Fox Records. And I called them up, and I said, you putting out this record? And they said, oh, yes, of course, the speech is in the public domain. Anyone can. I said, no, it's not in the public domain. We worked feverishly to bring an action in federal court. And in the hearing in federal court, the decision was rendered that this speech was not in the public domain. And little did I know that single act of statutory copyright protection would protect one of the most invaluable pieces of intellectual property that the King estate currently has.
Yeah. How much has it been worth over the years? Any idea?
I have no idea, but it's been the principal source of revenue. I'm certain of that.
Let's go back to the day of the speech. It's interesting that you tell us that the phrase, "I have a dream," was not in the text that Martin Luther King took to the podium, but it was an idea he had spoken of before, right?
That is correct. He had used that phrase, "I have a dream," in other speeches, and specifically he had used it in a speech he had given in June in Detroit, I think at a place called Cobalt Hall. Martin Luther King Jr. could speak in real time, and he could cut and paste from speeches or articles or things that he had said before. So the speech, the so-called celebrated "I Have a Dream" speech, was an entirely spontaneous and extemporaneous speech. He was not speaking from written context except for the first nine paragraphs of textual material, which I had contributed to, for him to use.
Right, which is really worth listening to, and folks can hear the whole thing. But you describe this incredible moment on stage at which you watch him decide to depart from the text and go on the "I Have a Dream" theme. Recreate that for us.
What happened is that as he is reading from the paragraphs which he had written, incorporating some of the language and material which I and others had contributed, Mahalia Jackson, who was his favorite gospel singer, who had previously performed, she turns to him and she shouts to him, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And he acknowledges her and momentarily pauses, and he pushes I watch him push the text of the speech aside, grab the podium, lean back and look out at those 250,000 people or more assembled. And I lean to somebody standing next to me. I said, "These people don't know it, but they're about ready to go to church." And that's when he started this extraordinary extemporaneous peroration. And it was mesmerizing. It was something, I think I used the word, it was like he had captured lightning in a bottle. I say that was Martin Luther King Jr. What you saw, you will never see again in a millennium.
You make the point in the book that you don't get the power of the words by reading them. You really have to hear them. So why don't we just listen to a bit of that improvised "I Have a Dream" speech.
"I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racist, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
After all these years, does it still move you to hear that?
Oh, it certainly does. It moves me. Yes, the answer is yes. In fact, in my lectures and teaching at Stanford University, I say to students, the only speech historically that I think that has a comparison is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
Did it feel at the time that you were experiencing something historic?
After the speech, I thought that I had witnessed and I participated in a transcendental moment. Actually, I went up to him, several people did, and pulled him on the shoulder, and I said, you know, listening to you was like listening to Charlie Parker and John Coltrane and some of the great artists. He had this ability to improvise. It was something so extraordinary that you had to see it and hear it to appreciate it and believe it.
We're speaking with Clarence B. Jones. He has written the book with Stuart Connelly, Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. You know, you mention in the book that in a meeting, I believe I'm remembering this correctly, with Robert Kennedy in June of 1963, mm-hmm. that he asserted that because of the progress that he and his brother and others were making in the area of civil rights, that in 40 years, a Negro could become president. Did you ever think you'd see an African-American president in your lifetime?
No, I did not. And I think you're referring to a meeting that Robert Kennedy, I think when he made that statement, was during a course, he was meeting with James Baldwin, Lena Horne,
okay.
Mary Belafonte, Ring Torrance. No, the answer to your question, no, I did not believe it would happen.
Last summer, Glenn Beck, the cable talk show host, held a Restore America's Honor rally at the Lincoln Memorial, hearkening back to the march in 1963 and Martin Luther King's speech. And many people were very critical. Al Sharpton accused him of hijacking a movement that had changed America. You see it differently, right?
Yeah, I see it differently. The way I see it is that the rally that Glenn Beck held, first of all, you have to just – it was an extraordinary acknowledgement of the power of the legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr. I mean, he was seeking to make his rally relevant because of what took place on August 28, 1963. There will always be efforts from persons who differ with what Martin King stood for, from those persons to appropriate him for their own purposes. This is one of the reasons that prompted me to write an earlier book called What Would Martin Say? Because I got sick and tired of having people pimp Martin King's legacy for their own personal political purposes. And I watched the Glenn Beck rally from beginning to end, and I thought that while I disagreed with some of the ways in which he interpreted the prior a rally of Martin King at the same place. Nevertheless, he did give due deference and acknowledgement to the contribution of Martin Luther King Jr. on that date and at that place.
I have to note that at the end of the book, you take some stock of how far America has come since 1963, and you talk about the importance of redressing some of the economic inequalities that are the legacy of slavery and discrimination. This is a big question, but where are we on race in America today?
You'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to recognize that extraordinary progress has been made. But still, even with an African-American president, the question of race or race relations still remains what I call the 800-pound gorilla in the living room of all American households. it's still something that haunts us, that makes us uncomfortable. And I think that is largely because there's never been a sufficient reconciliation after slavery of the American psyche, the American institutions. Yes, there's been an apology for slavery. But the question is, that institution, which was so searing and so extraordinarily deep in our national fiber, that we are still suffering from the consequences of that. The principal issue today is one not just for African Americans, but really the income inequality. And then for the African American community, I mean, if Martin were alive today, I mean, he would be appalled, as I am, and I'm sure many other people of goodwill who are concerned about the progress of African Americans. I mean, how can you not be concerned when you see the wanton violence that takes place, principally gun violence, the high incidence of out-of-wedlock children in the African American community, the 45% or more incidence of HIV virus? There are things which are occurring in the African-American community where African-American leaders have to be very candid and comfortable enough to say, hey, these things are not because of what, quote, the white man did to us. It's because of what we are doing to ourselves or what we are failing to take advantage of. So even with the extraordinary achievement of an African-American president, yes, the glass is half full, but we still have a way to go the filter glass up to the top.
Well, Clarence Jones, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Clarence Jones is a scholar in residence and visiting professor at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. He also writes regularly for the Huffington Post. His new book is called Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. Coming up, writer Hampton sides on the events leading up to King's assassination in 1968. This is Fresh Air. Earlier this year, writer Hampton Sides published a gripping and detailed account of the months leading up to Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968. Sides' book reconstructs the movements and activities of King's confessed assassin, James Earl Ray, intercut with the story of King, the man Ray was stalking. Hampton Sides is an editor-at-large for Outside Magazine and author of the historical books Ghost Soldiers and Blood and Thunder. I spoke to him in April about his book, Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. I asked him about King's activities and his frame of mind in the final weeks of his life.
This is a very different Martin Luther King than I think most of us are familiar with. He had been getting death threats for really his whole career, but in those last few weeks and months, he was getting more of them, and the whole thing was intensifying. He had developed enemies and lost a lot of his allies in Washington because of his criticism of the Vietnam War. And it felt like he was in danger of being outflanked by the Black Power movement. He was not sleeping very well. He was smoking. He was eating too much and gaining weight. His marriage with Coretta was unraveling. It was a very dark and very intense and desperate time for him. And he had just hatched this very controversial Poor People's Campaign, which was essentially the idea was to build an enormous shanty town on the Mall in Washington, bring the poor people of all over the country, not just African Americans, but American Indians and people from Appalachia, from all walks of life, to Washington to stage this sort of protest at the feet of Capitol Hill to protest the conditions in the ghettos and systemic multi-generational poverty. It was a very, very controversial and heavily criticized phase of the movement. King had essentially decided to shift his focus from civil rights to economic justice. And so this was kind of where he was at when he got the phone call to come to Memphis to represent the garbage workers who had gone on strike.
Explain just a little bit about this sanitation workers' strike and why it brought Martin Luther King to Memphis and what sort of challenges that posed for him and his movement.
Mm-hmm. His advisors thought that coming to Memphis was a real mistake. It was quite a kind of left turn for him to be making, that he should be focused on this thing in Washington exclusively. But, you know, he couldn't ignore what was happening in Memphis. These guys were striking for better wages and for better conditions after a horrible accident in which two garbage workers had been ground up in a faulty hydraulic truck mechanism. And when he came to Memphis, he decided he would lead a march down Beale Street, the historic avenue of the blues. And this was going to be it. He would leave Memphis. He would go back to Washington and start recruiting for this bigger cause that he was pushing for.
But the march really went very wrong, didn't it?
The march got taken over by black militants and high school students who were just out for a good time, and it turned violent, and there was looting and smashing of windows, and the cops descended on everyone, and it was really a nightmare for Martin Luther King, because his whole career, of course, was staked on nonviolence, and here he was appearing to be leading a violent march. So this set up kind of the third act, which was he realized he had to come back to Memphis yet again to lead another march that would be peaceful. And it was that third appearance in Memphis that got him killed.
Now according to the evidence that the FBI later developed, we know that James Earl Ray had a map with places in Atlanta where Martin Luther King might have been found. So it was clear he had an interest in his movements. Where did he go to finally get the perch from which he would fire the fatal shot?
Ray ended up checking into a flop house on South Main, which was directly across from the Lorraine Motel. He was shown a room that faced towards Main Street, which would be the other side of the building, and he immediately said, "No, thank you, I don't want that." And then he was shown a room on the backside that faced the Lorraine, and he immediately took that and paid a week's rent, which makes most of us think that he was thinking he'd be there a while, that he probably wasn't going to be doing an assassination from that room, that he was simply going to use that room as a perch to follow King's movements, thinking the lawyers are going to be working this out for weeks, for at least a days, up to a week, until they would actually get to do this march. So I don't think he thought the assassination would take place there.
As it happened, his opportunity came that very day. Now, did he actually have a shot at King from the room that he rented?
He did, but he would have had to have leaned out over the window and expose himself. The angle is less than ideal. The only way he could really get a direct shot was to go down to the communal bathroom, which was this filthy room, you know, down the hall, that had a direct shot if he stood in the bathtub. After the assassination, the police found that the window in the bathroom had been jerked up about 5 inches. The screen had been jimmied from its groove, and there was a palm print on the wall, and various people in the flophouse had heard a shot coming from that bathroom. So it became pretty clear that's where the shot came from.
So it appears that James Earl Ray took the rifle, which he had purchased recently, from his room down to the bathroom where he could get a clear look at King, who, as it turned out, was lingering on his balcony. You also note that he realized that he needed some binoculars to really follow his movements. He went out and bought those. When it came time to get a shot, it's interesting he loaded only a single round into the weapon.
Right.
How hard or easy a shot was this for a guy who obviously was not a trained marksman?
You know, I've stood on the balcony and I've stood in the flop house, which is now part of the National Civil Rights Museum. It's an easy shot. It's about 200 feet. With a 7-power scope, which is what he had, it would be appear to be about 30 feet. King's face would have almost completely filled the optical plane of the scope. He was not a trained or, you know, professional marksman, but he had been in the Army and had fired that very caliber of weapon. And I don't think, you know, in the end, you know, the shot itself was actually fairly easy.
King was lingering on the balcony with some friends because they were about to go out to dinner, and you write that he was in a jovial and relaxed mood when he was hit by this shot, which caught him on the jaw and did terrible damage. The police were actually watching from a perch very nearby. Why?
The Memphis police had been following King and his entourage everywhere, and also a local Black Power group called the Invaders, who were in negotiations with King. So they had two black policemen in this firehouse that happened to face the Lorraine, looking at events through a peephole. So, you know, there were people watching this from various vantage points. And, you know, when this shot rang out, these policemen all ran outside from the firehouse and ran towards Lorraine, trying to figure out, you know, which direction did the shot come from.
And the firehouse was literally next door to the boarding house that Ray was perched in?
It's across the street.
Okay.
It's about like 200, maybe 250 feet away.
It does seem remarkable that with the police in a firehouse very nearby, that James Earl Ray was able to fire this shot, which was heard by lots of people, and then slip away. How close did he come to getting caught then?
Within 30 seconds. He ran down the stairs. He took a left turn. He was running towards his car, which was the white Mustang that was parked on the street, when he saw some policemen who were gathered around that fire station. And he had to do a very impulsive thing. On one level, you could say this was a really stupid act. He ditched the weapon. Everything needed to solve that case was in that bundle with the weapon and various other belongings that he had there. But if he hadn't done that, he would have been called immediately with the weapon in his arms. So, you know, he had to do that. He jumped in the car and took off, and there were several witnesses there who saw the white Mustang as it took off heading north on Main Street. So, you know, he came probably within 30 seconds of getting caught.
Well, for 2 months he managed to evade the FBI, which despite Hoover's antipathy for King, was actively investigating this, throwing all of the resources they could into it. He finds his way to Canada because border crossings were easy there. And then he figured out how to get a passport and airline ticket out of the country. James Earl Ray, after being captured in London, was extradited to the United States. He confessed and was sentenced to life in prison. And what I'm struck by at the end of the book is, in some ways, what a small guy he seemed. I mean, I'm reminded of the Hannah Arendt observation of the banality of evil. And I'm just wondering, do you feel like you understand him? Is he like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, some tortured soul, or like Timothy McVeigh, a young man who's ideologically driven? Do you feel like you get him?
I get parts of him. You know, I think that there wasn't a single motivation so much as, you know, kind of an amalgam of sub-motivations that he kind of threw into a blender and stuck it on puree. You know, like, yes, he was a person who thought of himself as a businessman and as a hustler. And yes, he was a racist. Yes, he had a history of mental illness accentuated by years of amphetamine use. Throw all those sort of sub-motivations into this blender, and I think you begin to get some sense of how he could have done this and why he could have done this. But in the end, you're right. It's really about the banality of evil. It's about how a very hollow person can bring down a great man. And unfortunately, we've got a long and sordid history of people like that in this country.
Well, Hampton Sides, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Hampton Sides is the author of Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. We'll close today with more of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, and then we'll hear Aretha Franklin perform a version of the song she sang at the inauguration of President Barack Obama. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
We will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring.